Welcome to the Brecon Beacon National Park Authority's Waterfalls and Wildlife podcast. Over the next 15 minutes, National Park staff will reveal to you what wildlife you are likely to come across in the waterfalls area of the Brecon Beacons. To start off this fascinating subject, I eavesdropped into a conversation between senior ecologist Paul Sinadurai and local ranger Helen Pye, who were discussing this very subject.
It's always very interesting coming into this area because there's so many different footpaths you can take here, and it's always, you have to kind of be prepared for a long walk in and a long walk out to see the points of interest, don't you?
Absolutely. And I think the further that you walk up the valley, the more interesting the wildlife becomes, really. The whole area that you might walk in today is an SAC, a Special Area of Conservation, and also a SSSI.
Site of Special Scientific Interest, yeah. That's right, yeah.
And it's been designated as an SAC and a SSSI, mainly for its ancient semi-natural oak woodland. Is that right, Paul?
Yes, we have the oak woodland, which is on the more, if you like, acidic, kind of wetter rocks, and then you have the kind of lime and woodland as well, which is the small-leaved lime woodlands, which are tend to be on the more basic or sort of limestoney, sort of millstoney grit sort of rocks. I mean, small-leaved lime is the native species of lime tree in Britain. There are other lime trees, but those usually were either maybe brought in by the Romans, for example, or they've been planted in ornamental settings and as parkland trees. But the small-leaved lime is our native lime tree, and it's very distinctive because the leaves are small, and you know, they are much smaller than the bog-standard lime tree. And the first thing you can notice about the lime tree is its smell when it's blossoming in the springtime. And also, it just gives off this kind of limey smell, during the summer as well. And if you're downwind to it, that's the first thing you notice before you actually get close to the trees.
We'll return to this conversation later on. But as I found out when I walked from Pont Neuf de Vechan to Pont Melinvar with Helen, lime isn't the only plant here with a distinctive smell.
In the spring and summer, this whole area on the ground is covered by wild garlic. It tends to grow all up this valley. The plant is sort of 7 inches long, a green, shiny leaf with a pointed tip. And you can tell that it's here, because when you're walking along, you'll actually smell the garlicky, leeky smell. You can use the leaves in salads. That gives it a nice sort of garlicky tint. And if you rub the leaf in your hand, it'll give off that strong odour.
The plant you are most likely to see here, though, is the sessile oak, the national tree of Wales, no less. But have you ever wondered how it differs from its English counterpart, the pedunculate oak? Well, it's all in the name, and more particularly, the way the acorn is attached to the branch of the tree. The word sessile means stalkless, whilst pedunculate means the opposite. One way to remember is by thinking about a pendulum with the weight, or acorn, swinging back and forth. Paul Sinadurai has also observed some other distinguishing characteristics.
The leaf outline is less in and out, it's less wobbly around the edges, perhaps, is a better way of describing it. And the, if like the lobes of the leaves are bigger than they would be on a pedunculate oak as well. And in fact, I tend to find that the leaves themselves tend to be bigger than they would be on a pedunculate oak as well.
So now you know, why not have a look around and see if you can spot some of these leaves? Moving on, as you will have no doubt gathered from the title of this podcast, waterfalls are a major feature of this area. But how do these dramatic landforms arise? Geraint Owen, a geologist at Swansea University, explains.
In general, waterfalls will form where there's a contrast in the resistance of rocks to erosion by the river. So where the erosion of the river is interrupted by a tough, resistant rock. And in the rocks that we're looking at in the Neuf Vechan area, the tough rocks are sandstones, the weaker rocks are shales. There are two settings, really, for the waterfall. Scud Gladys is where the river cuts across a band of a tough sandstone, the 12-foot sandstone. Most of the other waterfalls are where there is a fault, a fracture in the rocks, and long ago the rocks moved on either side of that fracture. And that means that at a certain level in the rock sequence, there's a harder sandstone rock on one side and shale on the other side. So as the river is cutting down, If there's shale on both sides of the fault, it will cut down at an equal rate on both sides of the fault. Eventually, it'll reach a level at which it encounters sandstone on the upstream side of the fault and shale on the downstream side of the fault. Its erosion is then interrupted upstream of the fault, but continues on the downstream side of the fault. And that produces a waterfall at the line of the fault surface. Over time, erosion, slow erosion of the sandstone on the upstream side of the fault, causes the position of the waterfall to retreat upstream. And eventually, the waterfall will be some distance upstream, separated from the fault by typically quite a narrow, steep-sided gorge. And that's what's seen at the Horseshoe Falls, where the waterfall is now some tens of metres upstream from the fault line itself.
The conditions these waterfalls create provide a perfect habitat for humid-loving plants, as firstly Alan Bowring, Geopark officer, and then Paul and Helen reveal.
The best things is the vegetation that's growing on the cliffs that form the waterfall. So we're looking at things like ferns and horsetails and so on. They're close relatives of the sort of plants that were around, say, 300 million years ago when these rocks were being formed. So there's a sort of, you know, then and now feel to it. The ferns, the horsetails we see today, perhaps only a foot or two high, the ones that we would have seen in the Carboniferous period in these tropical jungles, and these were the world's first tropical rainforests, if you like. The trees then, these tree ferns, these horsetails, were up to 100 foot high. So we've really only got pale imitations of what we had back all those years ago.
The waterfall's obviously permanently wet kind of environment, and even when the waterfalls are kind of only a trickling over the falls, you've still got the high humidity and you've got the splash zone, and you've got the fact that the waterfall itself might be undercutting, because as we know, that's what waterfalls try and do. They cut themselves backwards to go upstream, and so all those conditions mean that they're kind of ideal for mosses. They're away from being trampled and disturbed. They're wet the whole time. They've got nutrients kind of getting trapped in amongst themselves and from the rain as well. And so it just creates the ideal conditions for liverworts and mosses and lichens to form on the rocks. And that also means you've got a permanently high humidity environment, you know, kind of temperate rainforest sort of environment on the tree surfaces as well, away from the waterfalls.
The most recent survey that we've got of the Nair Vechen was done by Martha Newton some years ago now, but she identified that the most important areas really for the bryophytes of mosses are above the confluence of the Perthyn up towards Pont Melyn Fach, whereas below that it's not so special, although it's still a lovely habitat. And I think the reasons that we think that it's like that is because below the Perthyn, you know, it's not such a humid environment, the gorge isn't as steep. You also don't get as much standing deadwood there, perhaps because it's closer to Pont Nefech and closer to general populations. So, yeah, above that confluence, there's some really important bryophyte and moss species. I don't know whether you know any of the Latin names.
I'm not the right person to ask. You'd need to have Martha Newton or maybe one of our colleagues from the Council for Wales to pick their brains about the names when you're out with these people.
It's a real specialist subject,
yes,
isn't it?
And they'll just kind of go wandering off somewhere, or they'll stop and stare at a tree and you're just about to walk straight past it. It's a tree with mosses on it.
It's amazing, isn't it? Yeah. Like how they can spot. And I think they just look for particular conditions. But you'll be out with Graham from CCW and just be walking along, and suddenly he'll rush into the bushes and
you'll bump
start peering at a tree.
Yeah. Yes.
And it's amazing. He'll go right up to this tiny little spot with his microscope and he'll be like, oh, come and have a look at this. And it's just a tiny little plant. But they are just so important because, you know, some of the bryophytes and mosses you find in this area just important Europe-wide.
They are, yes. And they're only found in these particular conditions. And the conditions that you find in these gorge woodlands are unique. I mean, they're purely formed by chance and landscape evolution. But that's what's so special about the area. You know, we actually, unlike a lot of biodiversity that we manage, which is, if you like, a byproduct of human endeavour, whether it be farming, whether it be byproducts of other industrial practices and so on. Whereas in the gorge woodlands, it's biodiversity and geology, and that's what it's done, and it's produced it all by itself, and that's what's so special. I mean, obviously, if we look into the industrial history, we'll find that the trees in this area would have been chopped down and taken for pit props, and they would have been taken for shipbuilding, and been taken for charcoal and God knows what else. But you know, the trees would always have been there largely anyway, and they've always provided that kind of substrate for these plants to live in. And that Martha Newton survey, I think she said she recorded something like a quarter of all of Wales's moss flora just in that waterfalls area. So it gives you some idea of quite how important it is. And it was just a sample survey. It wasn't a definitive survey. She just went to certain places that she had time to do in the time she was given. Because you've got that kind of transition from the open moorland, where on the woodland edges, especially on the coniferous plantation edges, which kind of frame the special area for conservation is framed by a kind of forestry commission plantations, if you like. And if you're coming in from the north of the area, you'd come through the plantations before you come into the special area for conservation. But those plantations kind of move out onto the open moorland in places. So you might have things like Merlin, long-eared owl, and certainly the goshawks, which are like a giant version of a sparrowhawk, will frequent those areas. Once you're back down into the gorges themselves, obviously wagtails, yellow wagtails and grey wagtails, which are migrant birds, and then the dipper, which is a resident bird, which is like a short-tailed blackbird with a white breast, dipping in and out of the water and flying up and downstream the whole time, and it nests in the holes in the banks of the river, you know, in the crags in the riverbed.
If you ever get the chance, go up to Scoob Gladys, take a pair of binoculars with you, and just sit there for a good half an hour or so. And especially in the spring or summer, I guarantee you'll see, you know, a good few birds, especially the dipper and the wagtail. They're just brilliant to watch. Like the dipper, you'll just see it suddenly jump under the water and then pop back up quite a while later. And it's surprising how long they can stay under the water. But it's really nice, relaxing thing to do. Like I always find that whenever I come out of the waterfalls country, I'm like quite spaced out, quite chilled. It's just a really nice place to be.
Well, for me, it's you can sit there and know, okay, geologically it's changed slightly, but what you're experiencing in there now is the same thing that people were experiencing hundreds, maybe thousands of years ago. It's just gone a little bit further, but there hasn't been an awful lot of change. When you get in close to those waterfalls, they haven't changed that much geologically, so you're experiencing part of living history, and you know that people have, you know, there have been footfalls there before you, and it's, you know, that's just, you know, you can feel the ghosts coming out of the rocks at you there, I think.
And it's those ghosts that inspire Alan Bowring.
We value the area today for its peace and quiet. We come here to get away from it all. But if you go back 100, 150 years, it was clear from what you see in the area that it was actually a hive of industry. You know, people were making their livelihoods out of the natural resources that they found around them. People were harnessing water power to create mills. They were quarrying the local rocks. So if you do cast your mind back those, you know, 100, 200 years, the scene would have been completely different.
To discover more about this, you will have to download the Geological and Industrial Heritage audio trails, which reveal how the extinct relatives of octopus once swam where you stand now, how the actions of ice dramatically shaped the gorges in this valley, and more recently, how people mined what became a world-renowned product here. That's the end of this Waterfalls and Wildlife podcast. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.